Okay, so today I'm gonna make Adam and Barbara very happy because I'm not gonna talk about slabs and saying that they are the only important heterogeneity in the mantle, which I don't believe. All I meant to say was that if you have a primarily internally heated planet and cooled from above like ours, then you will have a top thermal boundary layer that can be very dominant. That has been the assumption about the Earth, but you know, partly on cosmochemical grounds and also on grounds of how much heat flow is coming out of the bottom. So I thought I would show this again, the Earth's temperature profile, to introduce the other scale of convection, which we didn't talk about yesterday, which is a scale of convection that also arises from a thermal boundary layer. In this case, probably a hot thermal boundary layer, perhaps at the bottom of the mantle, maybe in the middle. And so this is Earth's temperature profile, and there is the top thermal boundary layer. And the reason the top thermal boundary layer is special for the Earth, as we showed yesterday, it's also that what makes it cold and dense makes it strong. And its particular rheological properties, it's probably what gives us plate tectonics. Then that's the adiabatic gradient, and if there is no mass interchange between the upper and the lower mantle, then you would have another thermal boundary layer, likely in the middle. So this is just representative of a whole mantle convection case. And what I hope to show you today, or at least introduce again some of the research that's going on right now, is that perhaps a picture like this that we might get today doesn't necessarily need to be the picture of the planet's history, but you can actually evolve from one system to another, and that that might lead to an evolution also in geochemical heterogeneity. And hence, if there is heat coming out of the core, which not if, there is heat coming out of the core is cooling, so that primordial heat is getting lost, then you have also a bottom thermal boundary layer, a layer in which heat is lost by diffusion, not convection, you know, rapid changes in temperature. How big this is depends on other things that are told to us by mineral physics, things like the melting temperature of iron or whatever iron alloy makes up the outer core. Now, Bruce actually mentioned this, but if you have a thermal boundary layer, you're going to get instabilities. Obviously, at the top, it's because it's denser than what's underneath. And at the bottom, if it's hot, it's because it's going to be less dense than what's above. And that's the case, usually, for what we call Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities. And we will see that at least for one scale of convection in the mantle, that is an appropriate model. Now, so what are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk about this concept of plumes, which should be the other scale of convection in the mantle. Now, we talked a lot about this, the boundary layer coming down, the top thermal boundary layer coming down, and that perhaps this that motion of the plates organizes the flow in such a way as to have long wavelength heterogeneity, maybe associated with the slabs, maybe not. Now, just by mass conservation, if something goes down, it has to come up. And how it comes up, that's another question. But because we also have heat coming out of the core, we're going to have these Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities. And this is a cartoon from Jeff Davies. And perhaps these Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities, depending on the conditions of viscosity and so on, might take such a form with a big head and a narrow tail. However, there's another scale of convection that I do want to talk about today, even though it's not the traditional plume, and I want to make the distinction between the two, which is not quite shown here, but there's going to be, because there has to be return flow from the slabs, there's going to be upwellings that are going to come up, material that is going to come up that has no temperature anomaly per se. That's going to be a passive upwelling, if you wish. Number one, but there's also probably, both because of internal heating and the bottom thermal boundary layer, and perhaps the characteristics of D double prime, there have to be large-scale upwellings. And this is something that is, if we can associate, whether it's temperature composition, the low-velocity anomalies with the temperature that are seen tomographically with the temperature and composition, then there have to be very large-scale things, not just very thin filaments of stuff. And these are the very large velocity anomalies that are seen under Africa and under the Pacific. And these have been in tomographic models from the beginning. Particularly under Africa, that has been, you know, a very robust feature there from the very first lower mantle models. So when I make a distinction between those two things, large-scale upwellings, you know, they're not really shown here, but something that's considerably larger than the scale of a 100-kilometer conduit that is hypothesized for the plumes. Now, I want to also make this distinction very clear, that, you know, because there's a large debate, and, you know, perhaps we're not the crowd that's into that, whether plumes exist or not. And, you know, large debate about that, whether plumes come up and so on, and, you know, hotspots, you know, how to explain them or whatever. So I want to make this clear distinction that the fact, you know, how to make hotspots and, you know, making plumes are not necessarily the same thing. Okay, they're related, but they're not the same thing. Okay, so when, you know, Don Anderson says things plumes don't exist, well, plumes are a fluid dynamical phenomenon. They have to exist, okay? Now, whether they come to the surface and make an island chain, that's a completely different matter. That's my view. Okay. Now, historically, of course, the observations have been at the surface. And the first to make the connection, well, actually, a very famous mineralogist, Dana, noticed some of the progression in ages. But J. Tisdale Wilson especially, you know, the founder of plate tectonics, he also noticed the fact that there were island chains with age progression that diverged from the ridge. And he, in fact, proposed a source for that that was deep into a convection satellite anchored in the mantle. Of course, at the time, they didn't think that the lower mantle moved at all. Okay, so J. Tisdale Wilson had the idea that hotspots were connected with some hot source of material that was giving it the volcanism. And then Jason Morgan came along, and he actually used the concept of the plume anchored in the lower mantle coming from the bottom thermal boundary layer and so on. Now, why am I going to cover this? I'm not going to I know I spend a lot of time on these slides, but it's very important in hotspots how you define it for plate motions, issues of two polar wonder, therefore rotational dynamics of the Earth. And that is because all the plate motions that we defined that I showed you yesterday are based on the record of those island chains from the hotspots. So the fixity of hotspots, whether they come, the mechanism by which they originate, whether they come from a plume that's fixed in the lower mantle is very important. And then, of course, there's the issue that they have a lot of chemical heterogeneity associated with them, very different from the ridge basalts that you get. And so that gets us into this fact, the fixity and the chemistry and the origin, and what is the possible convective origin of these features. So what I want to show you is, very briefly, a few things about plume in terms of their morphology, in terms of the comparison to geochemistry, all worked by a lot of people. The effects on composition, the fact that if there is a dense layer, some reaction, say, between the mantle and the core, that's going to affect the shape, the amount of heterogeneity, and you'll see also the fixity of the plumes. Okay? And then finally, so that I'm fair and I don't always talk about plates, but the influence of plates. If there is a larger scale wind that actually can capture the plumes, and that maybe we may be underestimating the amount of heat that is generated at the bottom boundary layer. Okay. So the definition of hotspots, you know, sort of taking off on Wilson, it's a concentrated volcanic activity, maybe linear volcanic chains in the interiors of plates that are shown here. Age progression along the chain, also chemistry of erupted lava, so it's very different. Now, this is my only, Well, anyway, I'll show you your chemistry slide. Okay, now, why is this important? Okay, because that age progression and because this causation between the chain and some mechanism that brings up hot material that then melts and forms the plume anchored in the lower mantle, people said, okay, well, then we can define an absolute reference frame that is, so that we can know how the plates move in an absolute sense with respect to the mantle as opposed to just relative motions. And so this was very useful. And this is what these two slides, which I also showed yesterday, are based on. They're based on knowing the relative motions between the plates and then also adding the component of what that hotspot chain tells you of the motion of that plate with respect to the mantle. Now, to be able to do that, and this is why this is important, you have to assume that the hotspots are fixed. And that's just a convenient construct, because in reality, we know that they can't be fixed. And there is some relative motion between them that can be measured. What that means, or has meant for people in the past, is that some people have argued that you can make this this dramatic change in the velocity of the Pacific completely go away by just saying that, no, the hotspots aren't fixed. And some people have argued that, and people are arguing in the opposite direction now. Okay? So the absolute motion of the plates, and therefore anything that we want about the temporal evolution of plate history, the things that I worry about and how they're connected to mental dynamics, depend on knowing those velocities in the absolute reference frame and depend on our interpretation of the hotspot reference frame. Does it matter? Well, it matters a lot. I'm going to give you one example. These are just, I just took the absolute motions, four different absolute motion models for South America. And so these are the arrows, these are in the hotspot reference frame for four different models. So here's a black line. This is done by redating, using pulsar rotation, redating some of the hotspots for the African plate and the Indian plate. Then the first absolute motion model, that's Minster and Jordan, and then another which was very popular, Grip and Gordon in the red. I mean, the differences are 30 degrees, right, in the motion. This is not trivial, right? So, what you assume, then what you can predict in terms of the forces driving South America will change completely, depending on that. And of course, the issue of rotational dynamics of the Earth and how the moment of inertia adjusts, which you can do by comparing to the true polar wonder record, also depends on the hotspots, and we'll cover that in the last lecture. Okay. Do we expect that if hotspots come from this plume, which we'll cover in a second, do we expect them to be fixed? No, we don't. Okay. First of all, the plumes, even if they come from a bottom thermal boundary layer, they're going to be less viscous than the surrounding mantle, but they would have to come up extremely fast to not be affected at all by the horizontal circulation of mantle convection. So what is shown right here is five different time slices of a calculation by Bernard Steinberger and Rick O'Connell of using a tomographic model to generate the density and then advecting the density heterogeneity back in time. And then the other thing they have done, and so the sketch here is the density variation. So red is low density and blue is high density. And then the flow predicted because of this density variations. Then you have two other lines, okay? One a very thick red and a very thick violet. The very thick red assumes this would be, a simulation for Hawaii, assumes that the Hawaiian hotspot is fixed at some point in the mantle, okay? And then I think this is right. And then the purple, on the other hand, it's actually moved by the mantle wind. But I don't understand why there's curvature in both. But basically, they have to come up at the same spot at the surface. But the idea is that if you do these calculations back in time, that there is a lot of motion in the conduit of that plume that is generated by the mantle circulation. As a result, the actual place of the hotspot might be different. But if you take that into account, if you take that into account in terms of the relative motion, and if you also take into account specifics of the plate deformation, you can actually start matching the hotspot tracks again with the plate circuit. And this is shown in this picture here, and this is the free air gravity anomaly in the contours. And then the hotspot chains are supposed to show up pretty well here. This is Hawaii, Reunion, Louisville, and Tristan, Tristan da Cunha. And then in the lines here, these thin lines right here, are different models. Okay, ones which include mantle wind, which we do not include mantle wind, and one in which you take into account intraplate deformation, so making the plates a bit soft, and ones in which you don't. What you find is that the best-fitted model, which has all the same parameters for all four tracks, actually reproduces all four tracks, and including the Hawaiian chain, even after the bend. It doesn't do a good job on the emperor. We're losing some information on the plate motions over there. So the point of this slide is that, yes, hotspots aren't fixed. They have to move with respect to each other. And if you take that into account, you take that into account the effect that the mantle wind is going to have on them, and you also take into account the effects of plate deformation, you can start producing a reference frame in which you can get absolute motions that make sense. Yes? Well, I think that that's the initial condition, that they have to show up at the same place, and it's at the bottom that they will diverge. Right, because they're trying to simulate the position of Hawaii today. Okay. Geochemistry. Okay, so this is a plot modified from actually an alumnus of Michigan, former student of Alex Halliday, Dan Barford. And it's a plot of the helium-4, helium-3 ratio for mid-ocean ridge basalts, as well as a series of seamount chains and so on. And mid-ocean ridge basalts, the point of this plot, at the top, that's actually R is the inverse of this ratio, right? Helium-3 over helium-4. And RA is the concentration in the atmosphere, right? The ratio. Okay, so that, okay, so mid-ocean ridge basalts look pretty much the same everywhere. They have very little scatter, and instead oceanic islands, you know, have a very large degree of variation. And I guess this is has been used to argue that there is a, you know, a distinct layer in the lower mantle where plumes come from, but it also shows a large degree of geochemical heterogeneity that it's coming up in plumes. And this has been the subject of a lot of work in the plume community, meaning geodynamically, to try to reproduce those variations. Now, okay, so hotspots and plumes, you know, they're related by causation at some level, but I want to repeat that plumes are a fluid dynamical phenomenon that you cannot get rid of, okay? You have a thermal boundary layer, whether it's somewhere in the middle of the mantle or at the bottom, you are going to generate these features. Now, the how these features change, the morphology of these features, well, that will depend on the rheology of the mantle, on the delta T, on the vigor of convection, I have to show you that, of the, whether there's a dense layer, compositional versus thermal buoyancy, and so on. Okay, now, this is a picture, a very famous picture of an experiment by Russ Griffiths at ANU. And in this picture, this is a picture of a plume. And now there's a distinction also that you need to make in fluid dynamics. And that is between a thermal and a plume. A thermal is basically a diapir that rises without a conduit attached to it. A plume has a conduit attached to it, has a tail. Okay, so those are two distinct things. Now, can you change from a plume to a thermal? Depending on the conditions, yes, you can. You can detach the head from the tail. Okay, now, in this experiment right here, they injected some fluid into, less dense fluid into a denser fluid with a higher viscosity, and they watched the material ascend, and then they looked at, you know, they did some imaging to see how much material it would entrain from the surroundings and whether the head grows as it goes through the tank. And they found that, yes, the head could get extremely large, and they scaled it to the mantle, and they found that the head could be about 1,000 kilometers. And then this was later associated with plume initiation events and having a very large head impinging on the lithosphere, large delta T, large region of melting, and flood basalts, which I won't talk about today. Now, so this would be, when this hits the lithosphere, that would be the first plume event, and then it would be continuously fed by this tail, which won't last forever, but can last for a long time. Okay, so let's look at some of these things. Now, a plume is a Rayleigh Taylor instability, I said that already. And if you go through, which I didn't do here, if you go through the derivation of Rayleigh Taylor instability, you can derive a characteristic wavelength of spacing between instabilities. Okay, so remember that. And that's interesting because I'll show you a later experiment where the wavelength is exactly that predicted by the simple theory. Okay, so how fast do plumes rise? The issue of whether a plume is anchored in the lower mantle and whether it's going to be deflected by the mantle wind will have to depend on the ratio of the vertical velocity of the material going up and the horizontal velocity of the mantle affecting it. So a very simple estimate of the rise time is to use a Stokes analysis, except we're going to do it very simply here, which is something that I got from Jeff Davies. So suppose you have a blob of immaterial right here that has no momentum, so inertial forces aren't important, so you're going to be in a situation of mechanical equilibrium. And it has a radius r, and you want to find out how fast it's going to rise through a fluid that it's less dense. Right? So the way to find this out, the way to find out this velocity is that it has to be a ratio between the forces that are going to aid that rise and the forces that are going to impede that rise. So the forces that are going to aid that rise are just gravitational, right? So they're going to be buoyancy forces. And those buoyancy forces, right, are going to be for the sphere, you know, this is the volumetric part, are going to be something like this. So So 4 pi r cubed over 3, and depending on the delta rho, right, how big this delta rho is going to make your force greater. Okay. Now, if this is a viscous fluid, the forces that are going to impede the flow are going to be viscous stresses. Okay, so viscous stresses are proportional to the viscosity, and they're proportional to the strain rate, right? And strain rates are proportional to velocity gradient. Okay, so the velocity right next to the sphere, so we're doing, you know, very simple analysis here. The velocity right next to the sphere is going to be over there v, and as you move away from the sphere, it's going to decrease, right? It's going to be a fraction of v. Okay, so let's say it's going to move decrease of a fraction of v by the time that you are an r radius distance away from it. Okay, so here then you can get the velocity gradients will be v of r, and then some constant, you know, because geometric factors and so on. Now, this is stress. Stress time area is force, so you can derive a force right here. So it's going to be minus 4 pi r, and this constant, the viscosity of the fluid surrounding it, and the velocity. So in mechanical equilibrium, the velocity is going to be proportional to the radius square, the density difference, and inversely proportional to the viscosity of the surrounding. Okay? If you do the actual solution as Stokes did and the actual analysis, you're not far off. It's about a factor of 3 halves. If the viscosity of the sphere is different than the surroundings, then this C is going to vary between 1 and 1.5, depending on where you're at. Okay. Now, if you do this, for, say, a big plume head, you know, about 500 kilometers radius, you get a velocity, and, you know, typical values for the lower mantle, you get a velocity that's 80 kilometers per million years. Okay? Now, that is going to depend on the viscosity of the mantle, right? So if the viscosity of the mantle is uncertain by a factor of 3, then your value will be uncertain by a factor of 3. So it can rise 2,000 kilometers in 25 million years, or it could take 80 million years to rise 2,000 kilometers. Yes? So this is viscosity, right? This is dimensionless. Yeah, there should be a parenthesis here divided by that. So it's dimensionless. Okay. So let's look at a canonical mantle plume getting generated from a thermal boundary layer. This is a movie from Jeff Davies. And you're going to see, so here's the boundary layer, and there are going to be some tracers here to show you how the plume goes. And you'll see that actually the plume does not entrain a whole lot of material from the upper mantle. I mean, from the mantle as it goes through. But there is a lot of strain going on, which are the white lines, all inside the conduit, and a lot of stuff going on inside the head. Now, the characteristics, the head-to-tail ratio, for example, are going to depend very critically on the viscosity contrast between the surrounding fluid and the plume, and also on what kind of viscosity it has. There have been some studies on the non-Newtonian viscosity of plumes and what it does. Okay, so large-scale boilings and plumes are not the same thing, and we're focusing on plumes right here. So I wanted just to show a few sort of pictures of what large-scale boilings might look like. Okay, so on the right here are some p-velocity models by Bosky. Well, the one in the middle is by Bosky and Zelensky. This is Sue and Zelensky, I think, and the bottom is Rob Vanderhilst. So blues are high velocities, red are low velocity anomalies. And you see that, you know, regardless of differences between models, there are low velocities in the middle of the Pacific, both in the big mantle and the deep mantle, and also under Africa, okay? So there are very large-scale features. If you can, you'll associate them with something thermal. These are large-scale features that they're not on the order of the thin, 100-kilometer conduit of mantle plumes. Now, characteristics of these features, there's been some work for the African anomaly recently, and this is actually a chromographic cross-section from another model. This is an S-wave model now. And you see that it also shows up in the S-wave model, this feature right here. This is under Africa, okay? And then Don Helmberger and his students have done some studies using arrays, I guess, and doing waveform analysis to look at the sides of this plume, to look at whether they're very sharp or not. And what they find is that, in fact, it is very sharp. And that's hard to explain thermally. It's very hard to explain something that would not be diffuse, and the thermal sense. So at the bottom here are some generalized calculations by Mike Gernis, and I guess there is a co-author in this paper, I think, in which they have the plumes originating in the bottom boundary layer, but they also have a dense layer in between the core and the mantle. And what they find is that, and then they've actually calculated the S-wave velocity profile that they would get to see if they get something very sharp, like predicted, but like seen by the seismology. So they find that they need this dense layer right here, but it cannot be of a delta rho that is too high, otherwise it just doesn't come up, it doesn't come up with the right shape. And these are different times, and there's also an effect of the plate motion that tends to shear the sides of this, ending up with a feature that looks, more or less like the seismic velocity anomalies. So the take-home message from here can be, and we'll come back to something similar like this, is that you have very large-scale features that are originating from this boundary layer, but they're affected by whether there is compositional stratification or not. They're affected also by the plate flow, and then you'll see in some experiments later that perhaps they're the basis of some other material coming off from them. Okay, plume morphology depends on viscosity, and I showed you this before, but I thought it was worth showing again because these were some of the first experiments that were associated with mantle plumes on the Earth. These are the experiments of Whitehead and Luther, in which they injected a fluid that was less dense and of very different viscosities through a fluid of a different viscosity. So if the fluid has a So if the fluid that you're injecting has a higher viscosity than the surrounding, then it rises as a finger, and depending on the time scales and so on, you can actually cut this off and make it rise as a diapir. In the case that the surrounding, that the plume has a fluid that it's very, very different, so it's much, much less viscous than the surrounding, then what you get is sort of a little spherical, well, sort of a globe, and a very, very thin tail. Actually, it's hard to see here, but actually a lot less structure in the head. If you have fluids that have, this is still lower viscosity, but similar viscosity, not different by many orders of magnitude, you get this characteristic mushroom head and tail, with a head that is still pretty large. You'll note that the heads actually obviously grow, the longer the time and the tank that they're going through. And this is one of the problems with the Griffiths and Campbell experiments, that if you scale their tank height to the Earth, it's actually 3 or 4 times the mantle. And that's why their heads actually got so large. In the most numerical work and also experimental work with natural generation of plumes, you don't get such large heads. Okay, now it's funny that this was associated with plumes. I mean, people took it, okay, and they said, oh, yeah, yeah. Plumes, this is their shape, this is what happened, because Whitehead actually says that this should not be associated with mantle plumes that cause hotspots. He actually says that specifically in his paper. Okay, so plumes, heads, and tails. So let's look at the shape of the plume heads and tails. I'm actually going to show you some experiments that I did a very long time ago, so got published 10 years after the experiments got done, but, better late than never, I suppose. Okay, so this is a large tank that we constructed while I was still at Berkeley, and it's 1 meter by 1 meter by 30 centimeters deep. And this is just a sketch of the tank, and what I'm going to show you imaging through this tank are shadowgraphs, which is shining a light through here, and so integrating horizontally through the tank to see the features on the screen. And the reason you can do this is that you'll have a fluid which is a hyperabundant lumber high viscosity, which is a corn syrup, and the index of refraction changes with temperature, and that's why when you shine a light through, you can see different shapes in the shadows. Okay, our tank was heated from below. There was secular heating, but the oscillations of the plumes were much shorter time scale than the general scale of secular heating that we had. And in this particular experiment, there was no cooling from the top. Okay, so for corn syrup, okay, so corn syrup also has a very strongly temperature-dependent viscosity, which is why you like to use it, which varies, say about 4 orders of magnitude from 80 degrees to about 20 degrees, okay? The Prandtl number at ambient temperature is, or room temperature, is 10 to the 7th. So even if you get to, in the the thermal diffusivity. Even though both the thermal expansion and the thermal diffusivity are a function of temperature, you know, it's not enough to really have any effect. So even at the end of the experiment, the Prandtl number is, you know, certainly above 1,000. Now, believe it or not, that's not enough to make completely sure that the inertial forces are important, because the Reynolds number, it's dangerously close to 1 towards the end, when you're at the very high temperatures. Okay, the reason I want to show you this is we're going to show you that the ratio of the head to the tails depends on Rayleigh number, and therefore that should have evolved in the Earth as a function of time, which is the next picture. Right here. Now, the Rayleigh numbers we got to at the time were the highest. We got to Rayleigh numbers close to 10 to the 8th, so approaching conditions in the mantle. This has been surpassed since. Okay. So at the top is a picture of, you know, after the onset of convection, of course, you know, which, and what you see is, yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if you can see the shadow so well, but here is one plume right here, and this is the shadow of the tail, and it's not like you can make such accurate measurements, but, you know, what we have to work with is better than the reproductions that are right here. Now, you'll see that there is an influence of large-scale wind in the tank. You see that these conduits are deflected right here, but what you'll see is that much later, when the Rayleigh number is higher, you can almost see nothing. And that's because the plume conduits are much thinner, and also the heads that are coming up are much smaller. But the ratio is actually increasing with Rayleigh number. And I know these are extremely hard to see. You have to spend a lot of time watching the videos to believe this. But we made measurements. Well, there is no cooling from the top here, so plumes are all there is. Right? There is a large-scale wind, and that's probably because there was a slight temperature difference from one side of the tank to another. But there is no motion of the plates across. I mean, we didn't have any conveyor belts or anything like that. And we don't have a strong top boundary layer. All that's happening is the bottom boundary layer in this case. It's all where all the flow is happening. And so any downwallings will be at the top. Will be at the top surrounding the plume heads as they impinge. In fact, we did some imaging that shows that the downwallings are all, you know, arranged sort of hexagonally and around the plume heads after they impinge the top. Yes, there is. Certainly there is. It's actually, it was almost an insulating top. Yes, there is some. It's actually down the side. It's on this side right here. I think it does contribute to the wind. I do think that there was some slight difference in the temperature from wall to wall, and that was part of the reason. But yes, that could contribute. Yeah, the temperature at the top certainly there was some cooling. Okay. Now here are the measurements that we did over which are plotted here is the ratio of the head radius to the tail radius, and I don't know why the bottom axis got cut off, but this is Rayleigh number, and so this is Rayleigh number 10 to the 8th right here, and this is 10 to the 7th right here. And the ratio increases, which means that as the Earth was convecting more vigorously, the plume heads should be higher relatively to the tails, and they should be decreasing, that ratio should be decreasing as the Earth cools down. And or as the vigor of convection decreases. Yes. Yeah. But the thermal boundary layers are getting smaller. So the tail, yeah, and the relative ratio is larger, so that would be, yes, and, okay, and that's okay, right? So the boundary layer is getting thinner, but the motions are faster because the viscosities are less. So the effect of the viscous forces is diminished. So one of the reasons you get very, experimentally at least, physically, one of the reasons you get very large plume heads at the beginning, so one of the things that happens in tanks, and the VI has seen this too, and in general you can see it also in the convection calculations, you can't, in the numerical calculations you can't because you said it, but it's that it takes the plumes a long time to come up, well beyond the point where you've exceeded the Rayleigh critical. Okay, the stability. And the reason is that because you're in the temperature-dependent viscosity, you actually have very strong drag forces from the fluid above, which is very cold. So you get heads that are much farther than you would predict otherwise. Okay, but as that diminishes and the fluid gets much more isoviscous, and there's just this tiny difference, most of the difference will be at the top, and the tiny difference between the bottom layer and the surrounding fluid, then I think it makes sense for things to be moving faster. So that was 10 to the 8, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 6, and that would be 10 to the 5. Yeah, I don't know why it got cut off. Okay, so that's that sort of has been the canonical view. Now, except that there's been a lot of work, particularly because in studying plumes, people have tried to and should try to explain the geochemical heterogeneity that is observed at the ocean island, in the ocean island basalts. So what I'm showing you now are hot off the press. Numerical calculations by Cinzia Farnetani. And what I mean hot off the press, these were presented for the first time a week ago at the meeting, at the SETI meeting. And she was kind enough to send me all this stuff, and so I've made a little movie of what she sent me. And what you'll see first is that this is the box that she has. She's using a three-dimensional Cartesian box. Okay, and she's setting the temperature at the bottom to some reasonable value for the Earth and isothermal condition. She also has a plate velocity at the surface. She has a small dense layer at the bottom. These calculations are fully compressible, and they also have the effect of a phase transition in the olivine system at 660. And you'll see that the influence of the composition, and we'll look at the tracer field later, and of the phase transition and the plate velocity is to change the morphology of the plumes dramatically. This is also temperature-dependent viscosity. Okay, so you'll see that there's a lot of roughness on the boundary. So first you'll see the whole box, and then you'll see focusing on just a couple of plumes. And her interpretations, which is what I'm giving you, is that what you'll see are plumes that come up essentially without a big head, plumes that come up with a head, ponding at the 660, and then sort of filamentous structure that it's coming up. And the heterogeneity is going to be influenced by that. Now, I know I'm taking a long time, but one of the questions that they want to answer is that, okay, is the heterogeneous nature of the chemistry that you see on the ocean island basalts, is that because it's inherited from the source and hence trying to look at a dense layer here, or is that because of picking up material as you go up? Okay? And the answers that come out is that most of the heterogeneity, because most of the stuff that's been entrained is at the bottom, is actually coming from the source. At least that's their inference. Okay. So let's see if the movie works. These are just different, this is not a real movie. It's just a bunch of frames put together. And so you see the material ponding at 660, and then you see that this effect right here, this is due to the plate motion, that it's taking the material and it's shearing it in the wind away, like that. But there's a lot of different structures. Let me see if I can run this again. Why not? Up left? Lower left? No. Okay. But I bet if I do this, I can do it again. Okay. So, they all have some heads. But, there's going to be some, and there's an enormous amount of structure. There's isosurfaces of temperature that you're looking at, which is of a potential temperature of 250 degrees C. But a lot of structure in the temperature. And then she also sent me, these are two-dimensional slices through one plume now. And first, I've made a movie of this, too. And so, here's the starting temperature condition from potential temperature. At distance from the region, you're also going to be looking at the tracer history in here. And you'll see a lot of different behavior in terms of the mixing and the heterogeneities that are taking place. And now, the tracers, if she's followed here, also in her previous work, represent uranium, thorium, potassium, and helium. And then they also make sure that they evolve with time and with the melting process. At least that's what they've done in their previous work. I don't know if these have as well. So first you're going to see what it looks like when a plume comes up with a head, and then you'll see one where the plume comes up without a big head, and then what you'll see is the evolution of the tracers. So here's one with head, and here's the tracer concentration, here's the temperature, and you see it in his without head. And you see that there's considerable more shearing. And then these are the tracers, how they come up and how they're sheared then in the wind. And one of the conclusions, at least that she's drawn here, is that some of, you know, the picture of concentric heterogeneities might not be correct or might not be what's going on. And also another of the things that she's come up with, that the tail brings up a lot more of the heterogeneity because there's a lot of stirring in the head, and that stirring in the head is going to homogenize much more what they see. So you won't see large heterogeneity in the flood basalts, but you should see it in the ocean island basalts as they come up.
From major at 670.
Yes, she has the endothermic phase transition at 670. But I think it's just minus 3 megapascal per second. But the.
What I was wondering about that is the temperature, starting temperature, bottom down, is really high. That's
250 excess temperature, sorry. Yeah.
So I would be surprised. What happens with these things is the effective phase transitions become more and more important to a higher and higher gradient. So I wonder if those really high.
Yeah, and I.
You might be able to start with a little bit cooler.
At the 4,000 degree drop, is that what you're saying at the coronamental boundary?
2,500 at the CMB, if you bring that up, so if you start at 2,500 at CMB and you take it adiabatically, compress it all the way down, you decided in the first class,
right,
you had 1,600 or almost 2,000 degrees for that, right? So that's 4,000.
Well, I thought she just had an excess temperature of 250 total. Right.
Those would make slightly more sense if you were actually real temperature.
Yeah, and perhaps they're just labeled wrong. You know, because they were isosurfaces of potential temperature before, but this might be real temperature. Yeah, it is a big effect, isn't it? But you know, one of the things is because she has this dense layer at the bottom, right? You know, the her plumes, I think, are less buoyant. And so they're going to be much more affected by the 660 just by having this dense layer as well, I think. So that might be the problem, one of the issues. Okay. To come back to heterogeneity then, one of the things they've done, this is a different paper by her student, Andrea Samuel, which I think he's now a postdoc at Yale. Actually, these are two-dimensional calculations, and it is, again, you know, trying to do evolution. And that's temperature at the top, and this is uranium at the bottom. These are, the tracers. And like I said before, they actually have it, you know, they try to take into account the time evolution and the effects of melting. And so then they look at the distribution of the helium. This is the helium, is R over RA, for their MORB source or for their OIB source, whatever they are getting their, you know, they're extracting the material from. And they get, you know, a large range, as is observed, and a much smaller range for the MORBs that is observed. Yeah, from the top, yes. Yeah, you know, so this is going to produce, you know, asymmetric downwellings like every other thing if you don't have, you know, specific rheologies. So this is temperature at a given time after evolving the field. This is not an initial condition. Oh, I'm sorry. What, this here, where they're pounding here, it might be a particular time. It doesn't look like that to me. It might just be at a particular time, these new things that have come down. I don't think it's quite ponding, but it could be. Yeah, but I think they have temperature dependent. Yeah, which is true, but I think they do have temperature dependent viscosity. 1%? I think so. I think, you know, if you make it much more than that, it doesn't come up. But maybe in two-dimensional calculations, you know, it might, you know, because of course as you go to a sphere in three dimensions, that the percentage that goes down, that so it could be maybe well as high as 2%. I think so. I think, you know, that the aspect ratios are of the box are what they should be for, you know, a whole mantle layer. Okay. Now, let's see. Okay. I wanted to make a point here, and that is in the behavior of the plumes that you saw before, that there is a lot of time evolution in the system. And that, you know, the fact that the heterogeneity, the geochemistry also gives us time. And, you know, we don't have to come up with a single dynamical picture. That maybe there is a dynamical evolution tracking together with the chemical evolution. And I think that has been one of the points of a lot of work on upwellings and plumes that has been going on experimentally in particular, such as the work of Anne de Vaille and her group at the IPG in France. And in particular here, and I know that's really hard to see, but let me see if I can reproduce this. This is the evolution, the time evolution of one single experiment. These are tank experiments now again. And now these are fluids with different viscosities and different densities. And so you start with a fluid at the bottom, which has a different density and a different viscosity. It's actually higher density than the fluid at the top. Okay, and then you just watch the time evolution. So it's generally equilibrated system. Okay, you know, after it's equilibrated, I mean, after it's reached the equilibrium, after all the transient initial states are gone. And what you see is, you know, an evolution with a lot of deformation in the boundary. And as the material, you know, heats up and changes, you can get some of these domes to go all the way up to the surface. Then things to detach, and finally things to homogenize completely. And I guess Anne's point in comparing to these cartoons that have been made before, where these are the one by Paul Tackley, is that you can start, that the Earth can have within its evolution all sorts of dynamical states. And one which there might be complete layer, say at 660, another in which you can get a lot more penetration of the top boundary layer and have a lot of deformation on this stealth layer, as Bruce called it, or one where you have some initial primitive blobs right here and have plumes that arise from the top of those blobs here and here and not from the core mantle boundary, or a system in which you can have the top boundary layer come all the way down. And the idea is to see the correspondence between the experimental picture and the cartoon in isolated blobs of reservoirs, finally to a state where you might get whole mantle convection and complete homogenization. And this behavior, this evolution happens, and it happens, it will, when it happens and whether it happens is going to depend on the vigor of convection, the thermal vigor of convection, and also the vigor of the compositional material. So, for example, this plot right here, this is the ratio of the buoyancy, so the higher, it means the denser, the bottom layer. And on this axis right here is the Rayleigh number, which I think goes all the way up to 10 to the 9th. Okay, and this is a sort of a phase plot experimentally. And so when you're in a regime that it's you know, fairly low Rayleigh numbers and a compositional layer that it's not that it doesn't have a very large density difference, then you can have these large scale thermochemical domes with a lot of deflection and so on. And also you get small scale thermal plumes. I think these are the pictures from the two different layers. Okay. Or you can get a case when the composition is very high, where you can have complete stratification of the two layers. Even. Is that better? Okay, yeah, I know it's hard to see. The point is that you can have, you can evolve the system and that you can generate different states, and so evolve the dynamical state, and that causing an evolution, perhaps, of the geochemical heterogeneity. Oh, here. This completely homogenized. The two fluids have completely mixed. Okay. So, Bloom's and so returning to this issue of the dynamical evolution, also from the same idea of having a bottom thermobundy layer, or if you have some dense layer at the bottom, you know, perhaps there is a relationship between the plumes and the larger scale upwellings. And this is shown in this picture by Ann Davai, and she was trying to generate, you know, a dynamical state in her experiments, which is similar to that sort of layer that might be hiding in the mantle proposed by Lewis Kellogg and Rob van der Hulst and Brad Hague. Okay, now on the left-hand side here, these are vertical temperature profiles through the tank, and these are in the hot upwellings, and this is in other areas of the tank, so the filled circles, always the hotter. And so you'll see from the temperature profile, this is a tank therm, right? Not a geotherm, but a tank therm, that when the fluid is stratified, you get a thermal boundary layer in the middle, right? And when the fluid is not stratified, then you will get something that looks like this, right? That doesn't have a thermal boundary layer in the middle. Or something that looks like this, I should say. Okay, in the picture right here, so what she has, when you see the blue, this is because the fluid has been dyed, so you can see the entrainment of the material and where it's going, and you have the development of these large-scale domes that might reach all the way to the surface, and you can't see them in here because they don't show up in the light that you need to do this, but they're actually small-scale plumes that are coming off the top of those domes. So you can have a relationship between a large-scale upwelling that maybe is controlled partly by the compositional stratification and small-scale thermal plumes that maybe give rise to the hotspots. The top is actually the beginning of the, well, not the beginning of the experiment, but it shows the two layers, and it shows this doming at the bottom layer, and then it shows the small-scale thermal plumes very well coming out of the top. Yeah?
What role do you think that convection driven can talk about? These don't have plates and sort of cold down. Do you think that a lot of the structure would actually be wiped out by slightly changing atmospheres?
I think that she doesn't have experiments where they put a plate. Plate motion at the top. She does have experiments where the top is cooled. And I think some of this, it doesn't show up very well, but some of these do have it. But of course, you know, that gives you more of a stagnant lid than it does real motion. Yes, I think the small-scale structure might be wiped out, some of the small-scale structure. I think this, if there's compositional stratification, and there are no good models that I know of with, you know, plane motion and also compositional stratification, both, you know, that structure like this might not be so easily wiped out, just because the plates might not penetrate all the way down. And all you would do is shear the top of the layer, right? So maybe move these things around, but not wipe it out completely. That's just a sense. But to answer that question, I hope it's the next picture. We're almost done, I promise. Okay, I want to show you the issue of what large-scale flow does and whether the compositional stratification can induce fixing, hotspot fixing, or fixing of mantle plumes resulting in hotspots at the surface that are relatively fixed. And I showed this stuff at this these experiments the first day. I'm going to show them again here and explain it a little bit more this time. Okay, so this is the tank that they use, which is a bit smaller than the other tanks that you've seen. It's only 34 centimeters across, okay? And they have a fluid that it's actually, polybutene oil. It's still high, very high prandtl number fluid. But then they have the ability to inject another fluid at the base. And so they're going to look at equilibrating this fluid thermally, okay, reaching secular equilibrium there, and then injecting a dense fluid at the base and seeing what happens then. Okay. And this is the picture I showed before. And this is the amazing result. Okay, so the top is a picture of what happens after you inject the dense fluid. So they have this fluid that's reached, subcular equilibrium. They inject the dense fluid at the bottom because it's very thin. It doesn't cause any thermal disturbances, but this is convecting. And so as it is convecting, it's going to sweep and entrain some of this dense material. The dense material is shown in the violet here. Okay, and as it entrains some of that material, it actually causes these pits, the circular embayments. The material is swept, the dense material is swept, so that it forms this sort of connecting pattern like this. So it is swept through the sides of the upwellings. Okay, so that it forms, and this is their cross section here, sort of a little embayment where there's just regular ambient fluid, and then this peaks and divides where there's the dense material. Now what's amazing, okay, is that this picture is at the beginning. This is 120 over times later. This is exactly the same spot in the tank. And so that means that these things are fixed. The upwellings haven't changed position in 120 over turn times. I think that's pretty amazing. No, it's a higher density. It's silicone oil instead of polybutene oil, but it's low viscosity also. I guess not, because they weren't, because it was at the bottom and they injected it, and the thickness is comparable to that of the thermal boundary layer they were forming. So they thought they were getting pretty even distribution very quickly within the tank.
So in terms of the fixity of those features, maybe surface tension is helping to keep them fixed. I think they worried about that, but I think they tried to match the surface energy swamp.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, the other interesting aspect of this is that, which would be interesting for, past discussions of mantle convection and layering, is that there is a great degree of mechanical and thermal coupling going on. Okay, and so that they need a certain, so there is some regime in which they need a certain amount of topography to develop on the boundary layer so that when the fluid is entrained, then the hotspots stay fixed. Okay, so that there is a degree of a mechanical coupling of the flow with the thermal coupling that it's going to sweep these things in. And I'm not going to discuss the next figure for reason of time, except to just to show you, okay, that this is a conduit of the material coming up, okay? And each of these individual little lines is a tendril of the high-density material being entrained in the fluid, okay? And there's a regime without going through that. There's a regime in which, depending on the viscosity contrast and of the ratio, the thickness of the dense layer to the thermal boundary layer, you can get fixed plume conduits, and a regime in which you cannot. So I thought that was really neat. But to get back to Bruce's question about whether large-scale flow would wipe out a lot of the structure, again, this doesn't have compositional stratification, so it's a bit harder to say. But what it does have is in experiments for the first time, first a very large experiment, so you can get away, very large tanks, you can get away of any issues that have to do with edge effects and so on. This is a tank that is 1.5 meters by 1.5 meters by 60 centimeters, and it has at the top two conveyor belts to simulate plate motions and spreading. They're using corn syrup, so they have large temperature dependent viscosity. They're heating from the bottom and cooling at the top. I don't think they injected any, they didn't do any free slip boundaries, but that's okay. So this is what they find, and these are the pictures that show it, okay? They find three regimes when they have this scaled. Now, the velocity can be thought of as, non-dimensionally, as a Paclet number. So some ratio of the time scale for the, thermal diffusion, the vertical diffusion of heat and the vertical advection of heat, okay? the ratio of those two timescales. Okay, so they find these regimes, which are controlled by the velocity at the top and by the contrast in viscosity labeled lambda between the hottest material and the ambient fluid. The hottest material in contact with the ambient fluid. Okay? So if the velocity is much less than 1 in some non-dimensional sense, okay, and the viscosity contrast is very close to 1, basically in a system that it's bottom heated, all you're going to get is plumes. Okay? There's going to be no effect from the large scale circulation. If you get very large velocities and very large viscosity contrast, you get complete suppression of the small scales. Okay? All that's going on is that everything comes into sheet-like upwellings, which is what is shown at this end here. Okay? Then there's some intermediate regime in which the velocity is intermediate between less than 1 and 10. Okay? And it's a function of the viscosity contrast. There's no specific viscosity contrast in which some plumes are swept into the upwellings that are, you know, generated by the passive, you know, the passive upwellings that are generated by the motion, by the large scale motion. So there is some effect, obviously, of a plate scale, if you wish, you know, scale to the tank, to the earth, of the large scale flow. And what they find is that the viscosity contrast and the Speckler numbers, so therefore the velocity, control the boundary layer thickness, and therefore control the heat coming out. Okay, so if you're in a regime where you're sweeping some of it, you might be underestimating the heat flow coming out of the core if you just count the hot spots, because some of them, some of the heat coming out of the core is coming up through the ridges. Okay, and so depending on the viscosity contrast, the heat flow scales different with the Pickler number and the viscosity contrast. So their main conclusion is, which I think is interesting for the scales of mantle convection and the style of mantle convection, is that depending on the velocity, you can sweep some material through, and that therefore you're underestimating the amount of heat produced by the core, because some of it is being channeled through the ridges, and it's not just, and so the ridges don't represent just the internal heating. Okay, these are the last two slides. So where do plumes come from? Okay, all we said is that they come from a boundary layer. We said nothing about where the boundary layer is, although I assumed in the first slide that it was at the core mantle boundary. Pictures like this, the evolution of the dynamical evolution and the possible different scales that you can have, seem to imply that you can get them from the top of these, you know, thermochemical layer, and therefore at any depth in the mantle, really, that would be the layer where they'd be coming from. Or if you have a complete homogenization, they would be coming from the core mantle boundary. And perhaps there are different times in Earth's history where you have different different situations. So sometimes they've come from the core mantle boundary, or before they didn't come from the core mantle boundary, maybe perhaps they do now, if we're in a homogeneous state. Okay. So if the plume source region is the core mantle boundary, what is its structure? Now this is a question best addressed by seismologists rather than me, but I thought I would show you some dynamical calculations by Igor Sidorin and others. And this is interesting in the context of a very recent finding in mineral physics, and I'll tell you why in a second. Okay, so these calculations are calculations in axisymmetric cylindrical calculations, and they have a plate motion imposed. They have strong temperature-dependent viscosity. They also have depth-dependent properties of the thermal expansion in the facility. And then the other thing they have is they have a phase transition at the bottom of the mantle. And now it's not showing up in these figures, but there's supposed to be a line that represents the phase boundary at the bottom of the figures. And that phase boundary, the elevation of that phase boundary will depend on temperature, of course. And also this, they also change the amount of density difference between the phase, you know, between the phases. Okay, so in the top case, there's no density difference between the phases, and the Clapeyron slope is positive. In the two bottom cases, there is 1% density difference between the phases, and the Clapeyron slope at the bottom is negative. Now, the conclusions that they draw from this is, besides getting their downwellings to go all the way to the core mantle boundary, is that the presence of the phase transitions has a very strong effect, and what the Clapeyron slope is, has a very strong effect on the length scale and the and the morphology of the plumes and not so much on the downwellings. But this is a phase transition at the bottom of the mantle, okay? In, you know, near the core mantle boundary. And in fact, a suppression of these of the small-scale plumes essentially in the case of a negative Clapeyron slope. And then they ray traced through this, and they calculated some velocity profiles, and in the dotted lines is prem, and then this is the VS that they calculated. And the reason they did this is because of the observations of the variations in D double prime and the shear wave velocity. So that here's prem in the dotted line, and then there are other profiles of different regions which show a discontinuity, and then either it goes down straight or a slowing or a gradient that goes down. And the idea for the explanation is there was this phase transition that could explain this gradient that was slowly going down all the way to the core mantle boundary. Now, what's funny about that is that at the time they did this calculation, there was no post-perovskite phase transition. But now there is. So maybe they were right after all, except for the wrong reasons. So.
I thought we had said earlier that we did this post-perovskite transition.
Well, they did both cases. Yeah, so it would be this. Well, both the top are positive Clapeyron slope, the bottom is a negative Clapeyron slope. At the top, this has no density difference, these two have a 1% density difference. So would the denser phase be 1% denser?
Is the bottom negative? Is that what it's true? I thought
one is
like 670 and then the next is that 1%
density difference? No, this is, it's right here, it's right at the bottom and you can't even see the line. This I don't know, this is because of the figure, it just scanned it in or something. Yeah, there is a line. You see that there's a line here. It's very deep. It's right at the core mantle, you know, it's at D double prime. No, it's none of the top ones.
And it was intended to coincide with the top of D double prime.
Yes, it was intended to coincide with the top of D double prime. So it's down here, which is, you know, the post-perovskite transition is, you know, what the pressure is, 136, 135, 130 GPa, I don't know exactly. Maybe they don't know exactly. Anyway, I'm done.